Hi, my name is Dr. Yitzchak Berger. I'd like to welcome you to the Young Israel of Fort Lee for our Lunch and Learn program, the Rabbi Dr. Jacob Reiner Memorial Lunch and Learn. And I'd like to pass the baton to Rebbe and Judy Steinman.
Thank you so much, Yitz. And we want to thank everybody, for those of us, those of you who are in the room, I hope everybody's enjoying their meal. And those of you who are watching us online, I hope you have a good meal wherever you are in the world. So thank you so much for joining us for SPIRIT, the stimulating program initiative for retirees that inspires thought. I'm Judy Steinig, Senior Director of the OU's Department of Community Projects and Partnerships and coordinator and host for SPIRIT. The OU created SPIRIT several years ago as an on-site program, just like we have right now. And later we switched it at the beginning of COVID to an online program. And we're happy to present it regularly on Tuesdays as an online program for retirees, not yet retirees, baby boomers, empty nesters, sandwich generation parents, and seniors. Everyone who's looking for educational, intellectual, and spiritual growth. Periodically, we are able to host a hybrid program, both zooming out internationally as well as in person in various venues. Today, we are so happy to present a hybrid program here in person at Young Israel of Fort Lee in Northern New Jersey. We are so appreciative to Rabbi Goldberg, the board and membership for hosting us today, and especially to Yitzchak Berger for making all of the arrangements for the SPIRIT program. I'd also like to say thank you to Alex Cook, Roz Bieberman, Dina Dembo, and Sam Ulrich. The first three are staff of the OU, and they're here in the back giving me support. We really appreciate our team. And Sam is our photographer who will be taking pictures of everybody that we're going to be getting into newspapers all over the place. Our program will be presented by Rabbi Dov Schreier, rabbinical coordinator at OU Kosher, and he'll be speaking on the ABCs of eating out. This session is being dedicated in memory of Rabbi Schreier's father, Rav Moshe Natan ben Asher Zelig Halevi Zatzal. May his neshama have an aliyah. It is my privilege to turn the Spirit Forum over to Rabbi Schreier. Thank you so much, everybody, for joining us, both in person and online.
Good afternoon. At this time, they're going to hand out the what we'll call the source sheets. Don't worry, I'm not going to read the Hebrew that to make anyone uncomfortable. This is just the source sheet. You'll see on the back side, there's a lot more English to it than Hebrew. But we'll talk about those topics as we go through a PowerPoint talking about what we call the ABCs of eating out. Actually, this program started being called Going Out to Eat, What Could Be the Problem? Then people stopped coming because they didn't want to hear about the problems. So we started trying to be more positive in the title. So we call it the ABCs of eating out. If there are challenges or issues, they might come up, but this is a more, we'll call it part of a title. One of the things about Jews is they love to eat. So, there are many different venues where people eat. If you just look at the screen that you have over there, you have your ice cream this time of year, everyone's going. You have your restaurants, your coffee shop, your Shabbos Kiddush. If anyone's ever been to Lakewood, you'll see almost every gas station also sells cholent on Thursday nights and Wednesday nights. So there are many different venues that it can be referring to. So we're going to talk about a number of different halachic issues that come up that one has to address before they can decide that they're going to eat in a place. And then we'll see how they manifest itself on the back of your source sheet, right? What to ask about a restaurant and sound intelligent. I'm at a wedding at a hotel. What does the mashgiach have to watch for? I'm at a kiddush on Shabbos. What do I have to be concerned with? And we'll divide it into those three sections, and we'll see how each of these topics keeps coming up at each venue that you're talking about. So we start with the first issue that comes up is that of bishulakum, which is food cooked by a non-Jew. Chazal were concerned that the mingling of Jews and non-Jews would lead to intermarriage, and therefore they made a number of gezeros, a number of decrees that would prevent the intermingling, the fastest way to a Jew's heart is to his stomach, and therefore the interconnection between Jews and non-Jews in a significant manner would cause, they were concerned, would lead to intermarriage. So therefore, the first gezer is out of bishulakum, food cooked by a Jew. In order for something to be in the category or a concern of bishulakum, it has to be foods that are not eaten raw, right? But if something's eaten raw, for example, our apples, our peppers, our corn, and our hearts of palm, as you see in the first slide, all of those are eaten raw. So even if a non-Jew would cook that food, it's not considered a significant food that would be an issue. The second condition is the opposite, is eino nechal chai. So for example, you have eggs. Right, if you've ever been to a bris or to a luncheon where they're making the eggs to order, right, there has to be someone, a mashgiach or a person by the egg station turning on the fire. Potatoes, depending on the form, and we'll see as we go along the different forms, and raw meat, right? A Jew has to turn on the fire for the food to be cooked. And then the other question, which has become a much more popular question today with the advent of this somewhat popular food called sushi. You might have heard of it once or twice. That many, many, many people will eat raw sushi, the sashimi that's actually raw. But nevertheless, the most of the kashrus organizations are still concerned about fish, salmon, or any other fish that it's a food that's not eaten raw. The second condition is that it's eino olal shulchan melachim. It's not something that's going to be served at a state dinner. Now, there are different poskim who feel that the president or such eats breakfast also, but generally we're assuming that it's not a concern by cereals and other things. But what are some of the items? Potato chips, right? We saw potatoes might be a concern, but potato chips is not something that's served at a king's dinner. Cornflakes, cereals, cheese, right? So cheese is made from pasteurized milk. So the pasteurized milk is already cooked. There's no issue. And canned beans and canned vegetables are according to most poskim, are not a concern of something that's eaten or served at a state dinner. However, the second category now we have our steak, our french fries, our eggs, your potatoes, right? Depending on the way the potatoes are served. French fries may not be, but a baked potato or fancy potatoes would be a concern. And rice, the two main ingredients in sushi, just to put it out there, the two main ingredients in sushi, the rice and the fish, are both concerns for bishulakum. So one has to, you know, think long and hard before they're going to say, oh, what could be the big deal about sushi? There's a concern about bishulakum. But how does bishulakum manifest itself? Right, in a restaurant, right, the chef, that's an actual chef in an OU restaurant, but if that happens to be, but you know, if the chef turns on the fire, that's going to be a problem. Right, according to many, many restaurants and many hashgachas will allow the pilot light, if you see in the middle of the fire, there's a pilot light there, that even if the chef turns on the fire from the pilot light, that according to many poskim, that would still be okay. But then there's an issue that many people have in their homes, domestic help. Right? I know for many years we had a live-in taking care of our children when my wife was working. When the first step of the interview process, which they looked at my wife like she was from Mars, was she said, "You don't cook anything in my house." And they're like, "What? I don't cook?" Most people are on the assumption that one of the reasons you have them is for them to cook. And we said, "No, you don't cook anything. If you want to reheat something in a microwave, it's something that's already cooked, right? You double wrap it, you double wrap everything you put in the microwave. We'll talk about that maybe later, but no cooking." So one has to be very aware when you have domestic help in a home that they're not allowed to be cooking any foods that are a concern of bishulakum. Right? Who turned on the fire? Our second concern is the segregation of fish and meat. The halacha writes that there were health concerns and other concerns by keeping fish and meat eaten together, right? Many have a custom to have a little bit of a wine or schnapps after the gefilte fish on Friday night before they eat meat to separate between the fish and meat. But that let's see how this presents itself in different scenarios, right? Someone can help me with the pronunciation of this sauce because I can't. Yeah, thank you. Right, however you're pronouncing that sauce, right? One of the components of the sauce is fish, anchovies. Now you're going to find some of them have an OU fish on them, which this one does, and some of them have a plain OU. The OU's position when it comes to this sauce is that if the amount of fish in the sauce is less than 1/60th, less than shishim, the OU does not feel that there's the concern of a sakana, of a danger when it comes to that. So there is some that are going to be labeled OU fish, and some will be labeled OU plain, even though you're going to see anchovies as one of the ingredients. Next, what happens? You're coming to a restaurant now, and you have this terrible disease called fleishophobia. Anyone know what that means? Right? You don't want to be fleishic. Right? You come into a restaurant, a takeout place, you know, a fast food place, and they're selling French fries, and all you ordered were the French fries. And now you come home and you say, now you want to have your coffee with milk. All right, what's the halacha there? So if the French fries are fried in meat oil, according to most poskim, you're going to have to wait 6 hours before you can have that coffee with your milk. It may sound repulsive to you, but I get the question at least 4 or 5 times a year. A restaurant asks, someone wants to have a tuna pastrami sandwich. So what we tell them is that you know, if you look at our plates, even if we're serving fish and we're serving meat in our home, but they're going on the same dishes in the house, but they're not going on the plate together, right? So what we tell them is you want to give them a scoop of tuna and they're ordering pastrami, put them on different plates. What they do with it is not going to contaminate the plates and the dishes, but we can't do it ourselves. And the next question is, if you've ever been to a wedding, and we'll see this later when we come to the discussion about what do you do at a wedding. If you've ever been to a wedding when they're French serving the main course, so they're going to come and serve with their tongs the meat and the potatoes and the carrots, that they're going to do. But when it comes to the fish, they're going to serve the fish already plated, because in the kitchen they have a separate section where the side dishes and the fish are presented and prepared and served with separate tongs and separate knives, so the meat sauce that's on the meat is not getting on the side dishes as well. The next concern is we got a.
I'll just borrow this for a second.
But if you see wherever they ordered the food from, right, it had a seal on it, or with a sticker, in order for it to, you know, to be able to tell where it came from and that it was from. But the question is, this is a longer topic of what's called shiluach al de'akum. The food was sent by a non-Jew. What do we have to do? So in the establishment, we have to know a refrigerator with meat, poultry, fish, or cheese have to be sealed at night, especially if non-Jews have access to the food. The display case with meat and poultry, you go into your takeout place and you want to buy your coleslaw and your meat salad or your meats, right? And everything you see is in that display case. Either they have to find a way to lock the display case, or they have to put it in a locked refrigerator at night when they close up. And also, outgoing deliveries, when you're ordering from a kosher restaurant, a kosher establishment, it has to come properly sealed so you can identify where it's coming from. Right? Protecting the integrity and the kashrus of our food. The next most popular question, the OU has a kashrus hotline. Rabbi Nussbaum Shalita, who answers the questions, gets around 500 questions a week. About 250 of those questions are related to Oreos. About another 125 of them are related to dairy or dairy equipment questions, and the rest are varying topics. What's the issue? Right, and for those who are Svardim, they're much more lenient when it comes to this matter. The difference is whether you can put Oreos on your chicken. Now, it sounds a little bit repulsive to those who wouldn't do it, but for a Sephardi is allowed to put the Oreos on his chicken because they're dairy equipment. An Ashkenazi is not allowed to put the Oreos on his chicken, but he can have it for a Shabbos party, Shabbos afternoon, assuming he's not going to be concerned about the Pas Yisrael part of the... But dairy or meat equipment, right? The Haagen-Dazs sorbets that are not cream are also made with dairy equipment, but we come to the same question with our French fries. We saw about our French fries earlier that they're made in meat oil or in fish oil, what we're doing, that this is a similar question. All right, can these be eaten with meat/dairy? What about fish? Next. The halacha says, right, there's so much available today. You know, it was complicated this year. For many years, we used to tell people that you could use soy milk for a cholah for Pesach, and you could use almond milk for a cholah for Pesach. This year, suddenly we weren't allowed to approve. We only had one almond milk that was actually kosher for Pesach because of the advent of oat milk being made on the same equipment that oat is mamish chametz, right? So none of these items were available for Pesach to use for those who weren't able to use it. But what happens when you have a question of the Shulchan Aruch writes that when someone is going to serve parva milk, you have to put the almonds or you have to put the container on the table so you know that it's actually parv. So when we get this question, when someone has, I know it might hurt people's sensitivities to, you know, they serve beef bacon or something else, you know, for those who grew up in a home where bacons weren't even allowed in the house just because it's just repulsive. But for those who have gotten past that part of the conversation, the question is, if it says it on the menu, what does it say? If it just says bacon, you know, people are going to jump. Or if you have cheese in a meat restaurant, you have to have some type of indication on the menu and on the food that it's different. So, for example, right, if served by meat meal, do you require the actual container? So, at our fanciest dinners, the OU requires our caterers to use the item on the left, which is Rich's parva creamer, in order for them to know that it's not parva, because it's very easy to switch creamer for milk and no one's gonna know the difference. There's actually a way to test it. If you pour a citrus juice into the creamer, if it's milk, it'll curdle. If it's not, it won't, but that's just a test. But this is to serve the concern of chalav shkedim, of almond milk, that you know that it's actually parv. So we make them serve these portion controlled and these fancy dinners. This is what comes out with the dessert. But then you have to be careful. The coffee mate creamers have actual dairy in them. They are dairy. They're not part of their OUD, even though they're called non-dairy creamer. How's that? The dairy farmers lobbied the USDA that there's no actual lactose in it, so they were able to still label it non-dairy, even though it's actually halachically 100% dairy. The silk soy milk, it comes back to our same conversation with the Oreos, right? They're OUD, even though they're made on dairy equipment and there's no dairy in them, you can't serve them with your kugel. I know my wife, you know, makes a number of kugels with soy milk, right? You know, if you wanted to use it for a dessert, we can discuss it, but in a restaurant, we certainly wouldn't let them use a soy milk that's not actually parv, because, you know, today they're using it for a dessert, tomorrow they can use it for a side dish, and that's a concern, right? The oat milk, as I mentioned, is a newest entry to the parva milk company, but that created a big issue for Pesach. And the almond milk also, you have to make sure that they're parv and not even DE. So now, if you want to turn the page to the other side, we try to not go through actual reading the Hebrew to explain it. But now we're going to go to the other side, and you'll see the all these questions that, you know, how you can how you can determine, you know, what the answers are and what you get to figure things out. So we'll start off with a scenario that if I came and told you, right, the question is, who has the keys to 1, 2, 3? Store the gas in the refrigerator. So let me present to you a scenario just to horrify you for a second and then show you how you have to know the details and you can't just ask a simple question. If I told you that the non-Jewish staff had a key to the store and they go in and out as they please, so you might be sufficiently horrified and say, oh, then maybe I shouldn't eat in this place. But if I told you while the non-Jewish staff has a key to the store, only the mashgiach has a key to the, they lock the gas at night and he puts a lock over it and he locks it and only he has the key. And he has the keys to all the refrigerators and no one else does. So it's not necessarily so bad anymore, right? They can't cook. All the cooking equipment is protected from use. The refrigerators, they can't take food out of the refrigerators that are locked. So it may not be as bad. So you have to be careful that if you ask, you ask the question, who has the key to the store, and you find out the answer you get back is not the answer you were hoping to hear, that doesn't necessarily make the place not good. Right? Another concern is who's watching the cleaning crew. Very often you might have a staff that's there and the restaurant closes at 9 o'clock, but you have certain owners of establishments who are very careful about the cleanliness of their establishment. And they're gonna have for the next 4 hours at night after everyone leaves, someone cleaning the establishment, because when they come in the morning, they want the place to be spick and span clean, right? So you have to know who's watching the cleaning crew. We've had situations where, one of the cleaning crew went to a McDonald's and put a burger on the grill, and now you have a non-kosher grill, right? So you have to be careful. So that's why we come back to the original question, who has keys to the gas? If they can't cook, and you have, Amazon makes what they call a plug lock, right? You can lock the plug in place. You put it into the two plugs and you lock it and you have the key. So if you have a microwave or a toaster oven or something that you can lock that at night also to make sure that no one's using. Next. All right. What is the procedure for washing vegetables? In the late, early 1980s, the government was concerned about the magic insecticide called DDT, that they were afraid that it was doing more than killing the insects people are still eating, called the protein in their vegetables. So therefore, they lowered the level of tolerance that they're allowed to spray in the vegetables, direct proportion with the lowering of the spraying increase the level of protein in the vegetables. You have to know it that there is, so if you're asking, it's hard enough to make sure that in a kosher restaurant that they are actually washing and preparing the vegetables properly, to think that in a non-kosher restaurant, they're only using triple washed vegetables. Triple washed vegetables does not really clean it because they're only using water. They're not using some type of soap of some sort to get out the protein that's in there. All right, what is the procedure for monitoring the fires in the ovens? All right, you have your pilot light, you have your convection ovens. What is there a mashgiach? Is there an approved Shomer Shabbos? Is the chef a Shomer Shabbos? Every agency has their different policies, but you need to know what's happening there. All right, go back. How should I expect my food to arrive? All right, we ordered our food. We showed that it came sealed. But what happens? 10 o'clock at night, long day at work, your spouse is away, and you ordered from a restaurant, and it came not being sealed. Is there any way to salvage my meal? So the halacha says that we have to look first to see if there's a concern of switching, that he might have, instead of bringing from Mr. Broadway, he brought from McDonald's. Right? Is that a concern? But are there other factors that you can look into to see, even if maybe it's not sealed, but maybe you have a receipt and the receipt says Mr. Broadway and you ordered exactly what you, and they use a specific type of roll that the non-kosher restaurant doesn't use. This is certainly not what should be done. L'chatchila should be the ideal and the approach. But, when you're there at your 10 o'clock at night and you're trying to figure out if you can actually eat supper or you're going to starve until the next day, right, so there are certain things to rely on, but that's not the system that should be in place. Right? How should you expect your food to arrive? Your food should arrive taped with the receipt stapled to the bag to be sure that it wasn't tampered with. So who's responsible for checking the kashrus of all products? Now, the OU in our restaurants and caterers, we have a mashgiach tamidi in all of our places. And mashgiach is supposed to sign on all deliveries and check everything in. But when you come into your supermarket, someone was asking me a question when we came in about corn chips, right? So what's this, the potato chips of this company have an OU, but the corn chips have some other ashgacha on them, right? The person who on the shelf, who's packing out the shelf, is not checking for the ashgacha on the products, right? So you have to realize that in a supermarket or scenario that the mashgiach is not checking in every product that's going in. They hopefully have someone who's overseeing what they're ordering, but You know, mistakes can happen. On what product are they mafresh challah? Right, we know that when we bake challah, we're supposed to we take off a little portion and we burn it. Right, but it's not only for challah; it's for cakes, even the what we call a blil raka, a soft batter after baking. Right, so you have to know if there's if the agency is being careful to do what needs to be done. All right, what do we do with meat and fish? Right? You can't put meat and fish on the same plate. What about the side dishes that are being served? Right? What is the process of separating fish and meat? The next one is about our eggs. Now, this is one I like to have fun with a little bit. Right, Rama writes that the minhag in Klal Yisrael is that we check our eggs, even though the eggs are fertilized and it's not even a blood spot may not be a concern, but nevertheless, the minhag in Klal Yisrael is to crack the egg, you know, then check them. What happens when you're checking a lot at one time? So sometimes in some of our restaurants, we'll allow them to designate a non-Jewish worker who will be, you know, give him an incentive, a couple dollars if he finds a blood spot. But in the middle, you have to be careful that he doesn't have any red nail polish in his pocket, because that's an easy way for him to make a lot of money in short time. Right, and right, that's how your eggs are come. Okay, now we come to the next scenario where you're invited to an event in, we'll just call it the New York Hilton, just as it's a non-kosher hotel, and this is what people don't even realize is the agency that's certifying this event is not certifying the hotel, and in many scenarios the hotel has union workers. So even if you found the worker taking something not kosher, and you catch him in the act what he's doing, there's very little the agency can do to that person. But something to keep in mind when deciding. But right, check all the waiter's equipment. Anything that the caterer brings for a waiter to use, a staff to use, the waiter knows where the non-kosher is also. And you have to be very careful that not only the tongs, everyone, you know, especially a chef, is very successful on his own kalim. He's very concerned to use someone else's kalim, someone else's equipment that he's going to give him. So you have to make sure to check the waiter's equipment, right? Make sure knives are from the caterer, especially on the carving station. If you imagine the chef who can cut your prime rib, and instead of getting 20 pieces of a prime rib, with his knife, he can get 25, and you're doing a wedding for 1,000 people, right? That's talking about an extra 10 prime ribs that he's saving in the course of an event, right? So you have to be sure that he's using the knives from the caterer, especially on the carving station, because that's where the knives are really, really make a difference in how much he can get out of one corned beef or one prime rib, etc. Next, who's turning on the fire in the smorgasbord? Now, the good part about a smorgasbord is 85 to 95% of the food on a smorgasbord is already cooked. It's already been cooked in the kitchen. So even if someone else, a non-Jew, is turning on the fires, but we mentioned earlier the eggs, right? If they're serving eggs, either it's a lunch and people have eggs, or they're serving crepes of some sort that's also a concern. You have to be careful. But I remember many years ago, one of our caterers was doing the dinner for the city of Beth El in Israel, 1,500 people, and we had a pre-meeting with the caterer, and the chef asks the lead mashgiach, who was going to be kashering, who turns on, who lights all the sternos, you know, the gelled fire that they put in the bottom of these hot boxes in order to keep the food warm. Mm-hmm. Right, to which the mashgiach turns to the chef and says, "You are." You know, so the chef looks at him funny and he says, "I am." So he said to him, 95% of the food in there, the two things that are going in there that are not cooked, I'll make sure to turn on. But everything else, if one of them doesn't get lit, you're going to blame me. I don't have to turn it on, and there's 1,500 people. I have many more important things to be careful with. So you have to know who's turning on the fire. Next. All right, what is the procedure for segregating fish and meat? Right, it keeps coming back. A lot of these things just keep repeating themselves in different scenarios. Right, make sure all margarine is parved. Right, the caterer wants to do a fancy margarine rosette or something else. Right, you have to make sure that they don't have a parallel product. What does a parallel product mean? That if he's making a rosette for parv, then whatever he's doing for dairy is going to be something different, right? If he's going to make a potato for dairy, so the potato should be shaped differently. It shouldn't be the exact same thing. So you have an extra protection to know what it is, but make sure all the margarine's parv. Who are the waiters and chefs at the event? When you come in, we're still in our New York Hilton, right? You have to be aware who's going to be the chef, right? The waiters, are they the caterers' waiters or the waiters of the hotel? The waiters of the hotel know where everything is and where everything's hidden, and they can hide stuff themselves. So you really have to watch. The person in the middle is a chef of an OU restaurant and owner, right? People probably know who he is, right? And he's also a chef in an OU restaurant. But who are the waiters and chef? But 95% in the hotels, they're not using their own, they're using the hotel's chefs. Now, who is supplying the alcohol and drinks? Right, I'll make my own personal editorial comment that said, if you can get away without having alcohol at your wedding, at your simcha, matov manaim, it's better for Klal Yisrael, it's better for everyone, and it probably saves you a lot of money too. But absence of that, the bar is controlled by the hotel. In 8 out of 10 places, the bar is controlled by the venue. And therefore, you have to be very careful. And even when you tell them you can't use certain drinks, so you have aged in sherry casks, etc., you know, these are things that unfortunately people are very married to, no pun intended, that they love their alcohol and they want to have their drinks, and it becomes a battle between the mashgiach and the hotel. And we have nothing to do with the hotel. We have no contract with the hotel. We have no relationship with the hotel. The caterer is the one who's bringing us into this location, so it's very important. I apologize if anyone's relative or family member is in this business, but the bane of the existence of a kashrus agency are the event planners, because none of them have any hashgacha, and all of them do whatever they want, whenever they want, and they don't have to answer to anybody. So it really creates, and I hate to say it in a derogatory way, but the worst ones are Achenu Bnei Yisrael. The event planners who are frum, the frumer, right, are worse sometimes than the non-Jewish ones who respect what you're doing. Okay, now this is something that even if you don't go to the New York Hilton, everyone loves to eat, and everyone loves to eat by the Kiddush. So what are some of the concerns we have? Right, what can be heated for the Kiddush on Shabbos? Right, it has to be dry, fully cooked food. Right, you have to figure out what cholent is translated as. Right, what happens if you come to a Kiddush on Shabbos morning and you see stuffed cabbage with a lot of sauce or sweet and sour or corned beef or tongue or whatever? Right? You have to ask a question. How did, you know, was this in before Shabbos? How did it get heated up? Right, three real options for heating food. The first one on the left is this pot is on top of a blech. This giant pot, and there's a sheet pan on, and then you load from there. The old-time Israeli plata. And the third option is a shelf above the stove where you can put it. The fourth option, which is not there, is what many caterers do. They put it in a hot box or a warmer before Shabbos, and then they take it out on Shabbos morning. Right? Where are the challah and the baked goods from? So you have to divide that question in a couple ways. First of all, what happens today is the bakery is often drop shipping what they're sending to the shul. In Israel, Fort Lee, right? If a caterer is doing a kiddush here on a Shabbos, the caterer is not getting 14 deliveries from X bakery to their commissary and then dividing it and sending it. The caterer gives the bakery job 12. Is Young Israel of Fort Lee. Job 14 is Bnei Yishur and Tinek. Job 16 is Avas Torah and Engel, whatever the shul is, and they're drop shipping it. But what are they drop shipping? They might be drop shipping the challah, and they might be drop shipping the pastries or the finger pedophores. But what about the fancy cakes? Today there's a cottage industry that exists where people make these cakes in their own homes. They don't have hashgacha. They do have hashgacha, right? Most of the major agencies will not certify things in people's private homes unless it's a separate entrance and, you know, no concerns of yichud, etc. Right? But you have to know where the challah and baked goods from. You know, the challah, you know, all the challah is from Butterfly, right? Or the challah is from Zamitz, whatever you say. But that's only the challah. What about the cakes? What about everything else? Right? Is all the wine mevushel? Now, you know, there is a certain school of thought that say people you should specifically use non-mevushel wine for kiddush because it can only non-mevushel wine can be brought on the mizbeach, and that's what we are tables like the mizbeach, etc. Anyone wants to do that, bevakasha, do it in your own home. Once you come to a catered event, it's impossible to avoid both the non-Jewish touching of it and the creating a chil Hashem of embarrassing someone who would not be able to use it. So you have to make sure that all the wine is involved. Right? We love these foods. How are they heated? Right? If you have a whole carving station on Shabbos morning and a lot of the things have liquid with them, how is this heated up for Shabbos? Next, instantine coffee. Right? We can't have brewed coffee. We can't have, right? So you have to have instant for Shabbos. Can I open the packet on Shabbos? All right, so Rav Shechter Shalita, when we first wrote our Shabbos guidelines, spent a Friday morning for about 10 minutes opening these packets without tearing any letters. So that's why we write, if you look in the loosen powdered sweetened loaf should be available for the last line should be made available in the kitchen for those who will not open the individual packets. Even though you can, you know, people don't want to, so you should have the loose powdered or liquid that's not tearing any letters. Where's the hot water from? You're going to a hotel for Shabbos and 400 people in the hotel. The caterer's calculation is 7 cups of hot water per person. Smaller mathematics, that comes up to, I think, 2,800 cups. Right? That little urn is not getting the 2,800 cups. That urn, that, you know, which is connected to the water source, can give you as much water as you want. The problem is the most poskim hold you can't use that on Shabbos because that's, you keep heating up water. And even having a non-Jew, Rav Belsky Zatzal held that that's psikrei shali de'akum, which according to some might be mutter, but this is his kavana, this is his intention, and you have to have enough urns placed in the proper place for, right? So you have to know where the hot water is coming from on Shabbos. Right. Again, the same question about the non-dairy milk, both that it should be with the container and it should be parv, especially the Shabbos Kiddush. Right. Don't squeeze the lemon. I mean, the halacha says that you're allowed to squeeze lemon onto fish, but you're not allowed to squeeze lemon onto sugar or into your cup, right? Because it's schita, but you have to be aware. That's why you have the lemon juice or when your tea has lemon in it, so you don't have to worry about it. All right, what about cutting the cake? You're not supposed to cut the letters on Shabbos. So we had a scenario many years ago where the OU was doing a weekend and the Mashgiach noticed on Friday morning that someone had ordered a birthday cake and he wondered, what should we do? Rabbi Shechter wrote a whole long tshuva about how not to embarrass the person and how we can take the cake out for everyone for Pesume Nisa and it's a chumra and whatever. But you know, you have to see, you have to make sure when you read a menu, you have to see, make sure the cakes have on a chocolate today. Most bakeries, even on a Tuesday, do it on a chocolate just to avoid the issue for Shabbos. So this is where we end the presentation. We'll have a few pointers at the end, but if anyone has any questions, on point, please feel free for a few minutes, and then we'll, yeah.
Yeah, when I was a kid, I knew a thing called a blitzstock.
Yeah.
And I read that words, I know what it is.
Blood spot.
Yeah. And that was a big deal.
Yeah.
And I remember, as I
got older,
matured,
yeah,
in the business, became a butler, became a waiter, this one rabbi, very well known, who I won't tell you, you don't have to check for blitzdrucken because you mentioned them. Eggs today, the government does not allow to fertilize eggs. They're not going to have any.
Right, so
my question on this is, here you have the system changing.
Right.
And the government watching it.
Right.
Why are you getting upset? Don't get trapped on home for you? And why shouldn't you? And then, well, here we have a health and health law that says you can't make good stuff.
I didn't do it. Right. So let me answer you in two ways. The question is, when he was growing up in the 17th century, I mean, a few years ago, he remembers that everyone was all concerned about the blood spot in an egg. Said came a time that the government put in their controls where the fertilized egg could not be used anymore. He's asking, why is it that we still have to check the egg? So on a simple level, the Rama writes that the minhag is to check it, even if it's not. That's the simplest answer. The other answer is the sensitivity of a person. If they hear that you're not checking for blood spots, they're not going to want to use your cakes, because they're afraid, even though you're not going to see it and it's not going to come. That's just the fact of how people deal. Yeah.
Hard-boiled eggs. Yeah. That are, you go to a hotel or somewhere. I know that
they
make caterers make hard-boiled eggs, like in a special hard-boiled egg cooker. Have you ever heard of this?
So the question about hard-boiled eggs, whether if someone is going to a hotel, a bed and breakfast, and they have hard-boiled eggs, is there any reason that we might be able to have it? So the point of the question is, they understand the caterers use a specific egg pot. So growing up, I know my mother, Allah Shalom, used to have a pot that she only used for eggs. The same pot that my wife uses for to make your filter fish, she's making hard-boiled eggs. So that's what I see in my house, because, you know, Baruch Hashem, you know, we have a number of children, and we're not making seven eggs, we're making two dozen eggs at one time. So it's a different, I don't think the caterers necessarily have a specific one. And certainly the hotel doesn't have a specific one that they're, you know, the only scenario that you might have is the hotel is buying pre-boiled with Shavash Gacha. But if you saw that might be okay. Back.
You mentioned that not putting sugar.
Right.
Sugar solid, why is that?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Very good question. The rabbi should have a system where the kitchen is locked and the custodian can only get in with permission from, it could be the shul secretary, right? Or it could be someone, it doesn't have to be the rabbi, but it has to be a Shomer Shabbos person who the person has to know that if he touches anything in the kitchen, you know, that he's going to be seen, right? Most shuls have video cameras on everything today. He has to know, and it's important to realize that, you know, overseeing someone, all you have to do is one time ask him, how come you were on the other side of the counter when you were not supposed to be? And they'll know that Big Brother's watching. It's a combination. One, they don't have a key. They have to get permission to get in, so then they know that someone knows that they're in there. And number two, you know, oversight. Yeah.
What's an ask by the restaurant? The restaurant has a stock, right? So when do you have to go to the new restaurant?
So when the person asks, that the title is what the title of the first heading is what to ask about a restaurant and sound intelligence. That presumably you're going to a restaurant with Ashgacha. But let's say you're on vacation and it has Ashgacha and you don't know. Right? Yeah, it has Ashgacha, but you don't know and you can't reach your rabbi. He's not answering his texts and he's not answering his WhatsApps or his Facebook or his Instagram or his whatever, Snapchat. Rabbi doesn't answer anything within 45 seconds, right? So you don't know what to do now, right? So you have a guide, do you have?
But there's an OU restaurant you have to ask anyone.
I mean, most of these things are addressed in an OU restaurant, yeah. Yeah.
With hard-boiled eggs, you aren't going to give me a chance check for the blood spots. So how does it work in that
instance? So the halacha is that you're supposed to with hard-boiled eggs, you don't have a chance to check for the blood spot. What are you supposed to do? So the with hard-boiled eggs, the general custom is to cook at least three or an odd number at a time. That if one of them is but it's batel barof.
The person given Shomer Shabbos has a problem,
That's a matter of machlokas. The OU tries for Shomer Shabbos, but the OU doesn't let any of our restaurants or caterers eat non kosher once. It doesn't really come up. Yeah.
What about
food food's cooked in untoveled pots? So food's cooked in untoveled pots. The issue is on the person who cooked it, not necessarily the person who's eating it.
Yeah, a question relating to going to a kosher restaurant is not a question about the food, but about the behavior of the owner. If you've seen an article that a restaurant, kosher restaurant owner, isn't paying his workers minimum wage, should that go into our consideration of whether it's really a proper place to eat?
The question is, you know, things outside the realm of kashrus, like paying minimum wage or paying proper wages or treating workers in a proper way, is that something that Hashgacha agency is should take into account? So the challenge with that is you then become a different agency, and you run the risk of many lawsuits if you start getting involved in those scenarios. If it's sometimes, for example, I understand delivery people, they're allowed to be paid less than certain because of tips and whatever the rules are. I know they're trying to change it, but when we try and stick ourselves into that conversation, we don't know this little nekuda, this little point that's legal. Then we start stepping on landmines.
Let's call up the belly dancer.
Yeah.
The OU closed more than once. Removed its Ashkaka from establishments that had entertainment that was not considered appropriate.
So the question is about inappropriate entertainment at an event, and whether that warrants and the past has warranted the removal of Ashgacha. So the OU takes the position that someone coming to one of our restaurants has the right to assume of a certain level of ambiance. Now, I'm not going to start going into what they're playing and what they're in the background music and the 9 days in Sphira. But there's a certain level of objectivity that everyone agrees that this is over the top. So for example, you know, if a restaurant is closed to the public and they have a private party, there are certain things we might look the other way but in our contract, you know, the wait staff has to be dressed appropriately, et cetera. You know, but if anyone can walk in off the street, they have the right to be able to think that they're not going to be made uncomfortable sitting there. So that's in a position to take, you know, but it's in the contract up front. It's not something that we tell them, you know, after day three that, you know, we introduced to them. Yeah.
Regarding conventional options in connection with lighting, there are no hands which respond to court. The person wants to know, would this be a concern only for conditions prepared on site, such as trades? What about conditions that are already booked?
Right, so we have a halacha by Shabbos, ein bishul achar bishul, right? It's something that's already cooked, right? Does not have a concern of cooking it again. So too by bishul akum, if something's already cooked and it's fully cooked, then there's no concern that at the shmorgas. So that's why I said the eggs and the crepes were an example of something. Yeah.
You can put Starbucks in category kosher by ingredient.
Can I talk about Starbucks coffee? Starbucks is a complicated question. The plain Starbucks coffee has an OU. The coffee beans and the ground coffee. What happens in the stores? Many of the in the last few years, Starbucks has introduced a lot of non-kosher food into their stores. Once they introduce these non-kosher kosher foods and the things are being washed in the same dishwasher, including the coffee, right? So you have a concern there in the kiosks where they don't have these type of foods. So maybe it would be better, but you know, I don't want to go any further in that than that.
What about egg cooker?
What about?
That's
cool. Right. So if they're only using it for eggs, so it would be fine. But a non-Jew doesn't have reliability if they're only using.
They didn't clarify, probably that
maybe blood loss. Okay. Let's see if they clarify. Who hasn't asked? Okay, we can go around again.
If an parent can buy M&Ms, like,
right.
Or Hershey's, or I don't know,
candy is nothing on it, but it's kosher. If you go to another country, I sometimes have seen other places, M&M's or whatever else, but I always think maybe they make it in another
country. You have to see if it's product of Hershey, right? The question is about chocolates and other items that you might see in this country, and you even call the OU and say if it's product of Hershey, Pennsylvania, maybe it's okay. But out of the country, I was just in Israel for a few days for my father's unveiling, and it, you know, Hellman's mayonnaise in Israel has a triangle cake. Doesn't have an OU, right? It's made in their factory somewhere else. I'm not commenting on Ashgacha, just saying that these things have different Ashgachas outside the U.S. So let me finish up, and if anyone has further questions, we can do this more informally. All right, know the questions to ask. Don't be afraid or ashamed to ask. It's something people have to know. You have a right to ask. You're the customer. You're allowed to ask, and you should ask. All right, when invited to a simcha, call the caterer and ask these questions. If you're not familiar with his ashgacha, you're not familiar, ask him the questions. It is our responsibility to be aware of what we are putting in our mouth. If it sounds too good to be true, probably is. We are very fortunate to have available so much kosher food. We need to demand high standards. And thank you for listening and have a great day. But I want to just comment on that next to last line. We stop to think for a second. The fact that so many products, right? I see a bottle of Coca-Cola there, so many products have a hashgacha on them today in this country is nothing short of a miracle. Right? At the best case scenario percentage that you want to use for Jews in America, right? 1%? Right? That's how taking the most liberal definition that you want to take, right? You're not more than 1%. 2? Okay. 2%. Okay. All right. The fact that a company like Coca-Cola, Hershey's, Mar, M&M, all these companies put a hashgacha on their product is nothing short of a modern day miracle. Right. It's not. So we unfortunately have become so spoiled by the fact that we have so much available that we're never satisfied with what we have. We need more. We have to get more. Right. So can you get this one? And what's amazing is that I'm in the OU 25 years, and all the things that people were asking for through the years have actually become kosher. And I remember when Oreos first became OU certified, so the rabbi in my office who was taking care of the company had someone in his shul who was holding out becoming, was a balas tshuva and was holding out because of the Oreos. And he remembers he got one of the first five, boxes of Oreos. He brought her one of them, and she comes back to him and said, "It's not the same." They took the lard out of the Oreos, so it's not a, you know, we're living in a dream world somewhat that so much is available. And if you don't think this is true, go to Europe for a couple of days, see what it takes to try and figure out if something's kosher. Go to Israel for a few days. See what it, you know. What does it mean, especially last year during the Shemitah year? What does it mean, Yevul Nachri? What does it mean, Heter Mechir? What do all these things mean? We're very fortunate. You know, stick to the ones who I have a number of Rabbanim who call me all the time with questions. They've joked with me that they didn't know that they went to rabbi school to figure out all the hashgachos and Trader Joe's. Right, because that's where 80% of the questions come from, because they have stuff coming from all over. What the hashgacha? But stick to the ones you know. Stick to the ones you're comfortable with. Whether you live local, we have your local hashgachas and the major hashgachas. And don't dream for the things that aren't, because if they're not, what is it? If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day. Sure. So you can ask me for, you know. Okay. Right. Her question was about the Impossible Burger or Beyond Burger, these things that are made with that are parv. Can you have them with cheese? So the halacha is going to be the same as we spoke about earlier with the non-dairy creamer and the non-dairy milk. That if you're serving with cheese, you have to make sure that people know that it's an Impossible Burger. It's a parv burger. Or if you're using dairy cheese with a burger, making sure that you know that the burger is parv.
Used to make, you put the, you know,
So that's what we still do that. That's what we still do that with the non-dairy primer. The hotels that we certify, we make them do that. Yeah. Anyone else?
I don't know where the heck that comes, which I don't understand. If a Jew turns on the fire and then goes away, you consider that Jewish cooking?
Ashkenazim, yes.
It doesn't make sense.
We want to thank everybody for joining us online and in person. I was remiss. I just want to announce, I should have mentioned this earlier, that this program, beyond being under the auspices of the Spirit program, this was also made possible by Ask OU, that's a division of OU Kosher. The Spirit program has been so fortunate to get so many wonderful programs, like our program today with Rabbi Schreier. If you check ou.org/spirit, that's the Spirit Archives, you will find all of the other wonderful programs we've been having in the past few years, and we'll be having many more. If you've been in the room here, please make sure that you filled out the form. Like and share us on Facebook. Thank you, Roz. We are trying to increase our Facebook and social media presence. So always watch for us. We'll be putting all these programs up. And if anyone missed anything, either online or in person, we will be sending out the recording of this program, as we do for all programs, either later today or tomorrow. If you're in the room and you filled out registration here, we have to be able to read your email address in order to send it to you. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. Have a wonderful day.